Scripture reading this morning is taken from Luke chapter 22, verses 24 through 34. Luke chapter 22, verses 24 through 34. A dispute also arose among them as to which of them was to be regarded as the greatest. And he said to them, "The kings of the Gentiles exercising lordship over them, and those in authority over them are called benefactors. But not so with you. Rather, let the greatest among you become as the youngest, and the leader as one who serves. For who is the greater, one who reclines at table or one who serves? Is it not the one who reclines at table? But I am among you as the one who serves. You are those who have stayed with me in my trials, and I assign to you, as my Father assigned to me, a kingdom, that you may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom and sit on thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. Simon, Simon, behold, Satan demanded to have you, that he might sift you like wheat. But I have prayed for you, that your faith may not fail. And when you have turned again, strengthen your brothers." Peter said to him, "Lord, I am ready to go with you both to prison and to death." Jesus said, "I tell you, Peter, the rooster will not crow this day until you deny it three times that you know me."
It had been a heady week or 10 days for the disciples. It had started there in Bethany with the raising of Lazarus from the dead, a man who had been dead for 4 days, and they were able to witness this event. They were able to talk to him afterwards, have him explain what death was like. And then just a little bit later, on the first day of the week, there was the entry into Jerusalem where the people laid palm fronds down on the ground and shouted Hosanna as Jesus entered into Jerusalem. And then after that, Jesus went to the temple and he drove out the money changers and those who were selling animals there. And they knew he had really made the authorities really mad at him this time. And as they were walking there at the temple, he had begun to tell them, "Look, not a stone is going to remain someday." And we've seen in our class in Sunday morning just how elaborate and large and impressive was the word used this morning to describe the temple there. And yet the master had said, not a stone is going to be left remaining one on top of another someday. And then there came the time when they partook of the Passover feast. There was the setting up of the event, how Jesus told them, "You just go to this man and tell them the master needs a place." And he led them to the room where they would partake of the Passover feast. And then during the feast itself, the master himself put on a towel around his waist and washed their feet. And they knew that something, finally the kingdom must be arriving on any day. And as they left to go out to the Mount of Olives, to the Garden of Gethsemane, you can almost imagine the conversation between the 11 as they talked about what the coming days must surely be like. The excitement of what it was going to be like. Jesus, we just heard read, told us we're going to be judging the 12 tribes. And they got out to the garden and Jesus was arrested and everything came crashing down. The world as they envisioned it evaporated. Every one of them fled, deserted their master, even though they had not just a few hours earlier confidently affirmed their loyalty to him. How did all of this happen? Why did it happen? We're going to look at that this morning. We're going to look at just what it was that happened to the disciples here and to learn a few things for ourselves. But let's look at these events here of what happened then that night and what happened to the apostles, to the disciples, and be able to learn from it things that we can apply to ourselves. so that we can grow stronger as a consequence. There in the upper room where Jesus had talked to his disciples, he had just told them, as we heard read to us, that he had told them, every one of you are going to fall away from me. And he warned them there with a statement that we heard read just a few moments ago in Luke chapter 22. In particular, Jesus turns to Simon and he says, "Behold, Satan has demanded to have you that he might sift you like wheat. But I have prayed for you that your faith may not fail, and when you have turned again, strengthen your brothers." This was what you would call a doorpost saying. I know many of you have probably heard that. Some of you have probably heard that expression before, and many of you, I know, are familiar with it. You get ready to leave someone, and you get to the door, and that's when the heartfelt expressions come. For parents, it's telling their kids, "Drive safe." And I know it drives kids nuts to hear that. They roll their eyes. "Yes, I know. My parents still tell me, drive safe. I tell my loved ones, drive safe." It's just a heartfelt saying. It's another way of saying, "I love you." But there are other heartfelt expressions that we find throughout the Scriptures. For instance, Joshua 24, where Joshua laid out to the people, "Choose you this day who you're going to serve. But as for me and my house, we're going to serve the Lord." Joshua was at the end of his days, and he knew it. And he was challenging Israel to decide who they were going to serve. The Apostle Paul, we read in 2 Timothy chapter 4, where he says, where he tells Timothy, "I'm ready to be poured out as a drink offering." He says, "I'm ready to go." And everything he wrote to Timothy, but in particular there in the fourth chapter of 2 Timothy, could be viewed as a doorpost saying. And so what Jesus is telling the apostles, not just Simon, is that all of you are going to fall away. You're going to desert me. And yet they all affirm the fact. If you look, read Mark's account, every one of them said the same thing as Simon. "No, we'll not desert you. We'll die first before we desert you." What we want to do is to look at this warning from Jesus and begin to learn a few things from it. First of all, we want to note that Satan had demanded to have all of them for sifting. He said there, notice in the verse here, these two words, "you" in the Greek, are plural, whereas "these" are singular. So that he's saying, "Simon, behold, Satan has demanded to have all of you that he might sift all of you like wheat. But I prayed for you, Simon, that your faith may not fail, and when you, Simon, have turned again, strengthen your brothers." That's the meaning of what Jesus had said in that passage. Satan wants all of God's followers for sifting. And the sifting is nothing more than just proving that the individuals are nothing more than chaff. When you sift, and we'll look at that in just a second, you separate the chaff from the wheat. The chaff is trash. It is worthless. The wheat is what's valuable. And it's what you're trying to be able to obtain. But we have seen other instances of Job demanding sifting of someone. We read in Job chapter 1. Satan answered the Lord and said, "Does Job fear God for no reason? Have you not put a hedge around him and his house and all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face. Well, Job was wrong, but that didn't deter him, because we read in the next chapter, Satan answers the Lord and said, skin for skin, all that a man has, he will give for his life. But stretch out your hand and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse you to your face. What Job was trying to do is to say, look, you let me sift this guy, and I'll show you he's nothing but chaff. Satan wants to do no less to you and to me. He wants to be able to stand before God and say, see this individual over here that claims to be a follower of yours? They're nothing but sorry, pitiful excuses for disciples. That's exactly what he wants to do, and he doesn't care how he does it. He's going to prove it if he can. But let's look at also the fact that Jesus had prayed for Peter. And in particular, the prayer is rather interesting. Jesus knew of the coming test. He also knew the outcome. He said that Simon, as we've seen here, that he might sift you like wheat. I know about what's coming here. I know it's not going to be pleasant. And you're going to be tested in ways you have no idea at this point in time what it's going to be like. But he prayed instead that your faith may not fail. I find that interesting. If I were to pray for someone that I knew was going to undergo, was facing undergoing a challenge or a test, I'd be inclined to pray that they don't have to face that test. I would pray that somehow the challenge might be lessened, or the difficulties might be lessened. That's not what Jesus prayed for. He prayed that Peter's faith would not fail. Unlike Judas, who when faced with temptation, succumbed. Jesus prayed that, Simon, I'm going to ask the Father that your faith may not fail. I find that rather interesting. Jesus also addressed this in advance. We'll return to look at this evening, Lord willing. But Jesus dealt with this in advance. He didn't wait for it to happen. And finally, he needed Peter to strengthen his brothers. Sifting. What does that process involve? I remember as a kid going to my grandmother's kitchen. She had a flour sifter, and you put flour in and you turn this little crank handle. And I used to read this passage and I used to think, well, yeah, sifting, that probably tickles a little bit. That's not what Jesus is talking about. It's not what Satan has in mind. Satan, threshing and sifting are violent actions. No two ways about it. Here's a picture of a fella. He's threshing this wheat. He's trying to separate the wheat from the chaff. And what he does is he strikes it against the ground. The chaff gets blown away by the wind. And he's left with kernels of wheat that fall on the ground here. It's a very violent event. Here's a picture of an old combine. I say it's old. It's an old illustration. It's an old gleaner combine for those of us from the Midwest or raised on a farm. But this is put out by the Gleaner Company. But it demonstrates what the process is of the wheat going through the combine. After it's cut, it goes through various devices here that do just exactly what that fellow was doing in the previous picture. It violently separates the wheat, the kernels of wheat, from the worthless chaff. And it blows the chaff out the back, and the kernels of wheat wind up in the bin. Because of that, when we're sifted, it's not pleasant either. Jesus said in Matthew chapter 16, And verse 24, if anyone comes after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. It may be that you're going to have to someday deny yourself. That may be the sifting that you're going to need to do. In Romans chapter 6 and verse 6, Paul wrote that we know that our old man, or our old self, was crucified with him, that is Jesus. Galatians chapter 2 and verse 20, I'm crucified with Christ. Let me tell you something. You take your old self and you drag it to the cross, it's not going to go pleasantly and say, oh yes. It's going to fight you kicking and screaming. It's going to resist you at every turn that it can. Crucifying oneself is indeed difficult. And yet, we're tasked with doing just that every day. And it may be that someday we're going to have to turn and decide that this, what I'm doing in the past, no longer is compatible with my life as a Christian. I don't know what that... It could be any number of things. And yet, you may be challenged with... That may be a sifting time for you. Maybe that you're going to have to decide that you may have to choose between God and family. You know of a congregation that underwent a split. Those that... There were those that left that were in error. There was a family that left with them. We found out about this later. Surprised me all to pieces. What surprised me more was the why. Because their son and his family also worshiped there. And they had decided to leave and they wanted to go with them. That's sad. And I wonder how many times had that man and that wife heard this passage in Luke 14:26. If anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. I wondered how many times they had heard that. And yet, when it came time to make a decision between God and their family, they decided to go with their family. Maybe that we have to decide between God and our brethren. Probably heard Mickey use the term, preacheritis. It's alive and well. Sometimes we find ourselves susceptible to it and we're not even aware of it. That we wind up putting our faith and our trust in someone that is a preacher, or it may be an elder. Someone we have a tremendous amount of confidence in, and when they say it's this way in the Scriptures, why? That's the way it has to be. Instead of studying it for ourselves, sometimes we just let others tell us what we need to believe. Almost like the lady I heard one time that went up to a preacher and said, tell me, brother so-and-so, what do we believe on this subject? And that is indeed sad, to not have the ability to be able to decide for oneself what the Scriptures say. And so often we have individuals like that who have been Christians for decades, and they have no more understanding of the Bible than someone that's been a Christian for maybe a couple of years. We had a child that wouldn't grow hardly after a couple of years, and they were 20, 30, 40 years old. We'd think something was wrong. Yet we have so many times we find individuals in the Lord's church that have been Christians for decades, and yet they're still spiritual babes. I'd like to challenge each one of us to think seriously and hard about just how spiritually mature are you really, compared to how long you've been a Christian. We pointed out Luke 14:26. A few verses later, Jesus made another statement. If any of you does not renounce all that he has, he cannot be my disciple. I pointed this out before. I'm going to remind you. If you remember it, that's great. I'm glad you do. if you've not heard this before, let's notice what Jesus says here. He doesn't say that you will be a mediocre disciple. He doesn't say that if you don't renounce all that you have, you'll just be a so-so disciple. He says, you can't be my disciple. End of story. That's hard. And that's exactly the point of what Jesus is saying there in Luke 14. Being a disciple of His is hard. And it comes at a cost. And that cost is self. And what self wants. Taking a stand for truth can be costly. And that's exactly what Luke 14 points out. Many in the first century died because of their intention of not renouncing truth. Many in the first century watched their loved ones die horribly because they refused to renounce the truth. Taking a stand for truth can indeed be costly. It can happen suddenly and without warning. And we'll look at that again a little bit this evening, Lord willing. Benefits of sifting. Why is it that I need to go through all of this? And we read there in James chapter 1, verses 2 and 3, a passage we're all quite familiar with. Count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds, for you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness. We read this so often, I think we sometimes miss the import of it. When you meet trials of various kinds, what James is including in that statement are very difficult and painful situations, like what the disciples faced the night that Jesus was delivered into the hands of the authorities. They faced the prospect of either standing with Jesus and perhaps suffering the same fate that He was going to suffer, or deserting Him and running for their lives. They decided to run for their lives. Although not pleasant, sifting reminds us that we are pilgrims and sojourners. So often, we become so comfortable here. The passage that comes to mind, it's not in the same context, but we're at ease in Zion. We're comfortable in this life, especially in this culture, in this society. Life is not at all difficult for us. Being a Christian is not all that challenging most of the time. Sort of like the story about the preacher that was preaching about heaven and how wonderful it was going to be. And so he got to a point in his sermon and he said, how many want to go to heaven? And everybody's hands went up except for these two boys sitting in the back. And he said, wait a minute, don't you two want to go? Yeah, we want to go. We just thought you were getting a busload up right now. We're just not quite ready. Yes, we want to go to heaven, but let's continue to enjoy what it is that this life has to offer. And we forget Hebrews chapter 11. The story of how all of those examples of faith tell us about how they were sojourners. They didn't receive what it was they were promised in this lifetime. One of the benefits of sifting is that it removes useless and detrimental facets of our lives. And that is, it would be called chaff. You begin to see, it helps you to sort your priorities. It helps you to understand that, okay, yes, this over here that I was so actively engaged in is not all that worthwhile. And I need to let that go. And I need to focus on something else instead. That this really isn't all that important, at least not to my eternal salvation, which is everything. But looking at Peter in particular, because of his experience at being sifted, he was a much more useful servant. Or we could say Simon would not have been the Peter that he became without the sieve and the discipline. That's a hard thing to think about. As a result of our experiences at being tested, we do become more useful to God. One of the things that came out of all of this, he knew firsthand the power of Satan. Recall what it was that he said to Ananias in Acts chapter 5. Peter said to him, Ananias, why does Satan fill your heart to lie to the Holy Spirit and to keep back for yourself part of the proceeds of the land? Peter knew what he was talking about. He knew that Satan had filled the heart of Ananias. And he knew exactly how powerful Satan could be in any situation. He also wrote in 1 Peter chapter 5, verses 8 through 9, be sober-minded, be watchful. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour. Resist him. Firm in your faith, knowing that the same kinds of suffering are being experienced by your brotherhood throughout the world. Simon knew what he was talking about Satan being like a roaring lion. He'd experienced the hand of Satan firsthand. He knew about the suffering from being sifted. The entire book of 1 Peter, you can find signs throughout the book that point to this fact. He said in 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 12 that it would come. And in that particular passage, he describes them as a fiery ordeal. Very unpleasant. Chapter 3 and verse 14, he said we should not be troubled by it. We should be expecting them. In chapter 2, verses 21 and 23, he said that we should wait or endure patiently through these trials. Finally, in chapter 1 and verse 7, it's going to be worth it. In the end, it's going to be worth it. Peter says, I know that. I've been through it, and I've seen the goal, and I've seen the reward, and I can tell you it's going to be worth it. Finally, we too can become more valuable to the Lord, more useful after sifting. Various ways. When challenged to teach the lost. After going through trials or tribulations, we understand, first of all, this world is not all there is to it. There is something coming. And secondly, we understand the importance of making heaven our goal and what it's going to be like. And therefore, we want to help as many as others as we can achieve that same goal. We've been exposed to sin and to suffering firsthand, perhaps. Therefore, we understand that how important it is to teach the lost. We understand the need to defend the truth. I have a letter. It was written, really, I was looking at it in preparation for this, almost 10 years ago to the month, by a man who decided to take his family out of a given congregation because there was a problem with error being introduced, and he felt like what was going on was a disruption to the unity of the church. And so in order to preserve his family, prevent his family from being exposed to any kind of fight or squabble over the truth, he was taking his family and going to another congregation. Revelation chapter 21 and verse 8 lists all kinds of individuals that are not going to make it to heaven. I've always used that to remind people about liars being included in that list. There's another individual categorized there, cowardly. I rather imagine that the desire or the inclination to not want to stand up for the truth and defend the truth is one that would fall into that category of being cowardly. When challenged to defend scriptural teaching obligations, what could we be talking about there? Well, in Titus chapter 2, verses 3 and 4, the older women should be training the younger. Fathers are to discipline and instruct their children, Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 4. And then, of course, we have the statement in Philippians that we're mind the interests of others, and that includes the spiritual well-being of our brothers and sisters And if that requires instruction, then that's what it requires. How do we conclude all of this? Let's note something very interesting here. Jesus saw Satan as a real entity. You realize that? Jesus didn't mention this, that this mythological figure, Satan, no. He talked about Jesus as a real entity. Yet there are people today that want to say, this idea of Satan is just the boogeyman. And that's something that has been invented by man to try and make it out. You know, that's to be the one that we blame all the bad stuff on. We need to recognize that Satan is indeed a real entity. We need to recognize his character and his nature as well. Here's one that may surprise you. Do you realize that you have value to both God and Satan? Satan wants you because he's trying to collect as many souls as he can to be able to, I don't know if he sees it a game and says, all right, we get down to the end and I've got more souls than you do, God, I win. I don't know, but he wants your soul. He wants you to go to hell with him. Maybe he just wants the company in hell. But he wants you. He wants you to go to hell where he's headed as well. But you have value to God. You realize that? You have value to God. To the creator of the universe, there's value in you. There's so much value in you. He was willing to send his only son to die a terrible and a cruel and an inhumane death so that he could be the perfect sacrifice to satisfy God's justice for payment for sin. Remember Jesus' prayer, what he prayed for Simon? Instead of praying for lighter loads, maybe we ought to be praying for stronger shoulders. I don't know about any of you. I have used to hear frequently in public prayers, individuals praying, Lord, wear us out in your service. Think about that. What a request to God. Wear us out in your service. And yet so often our prayers are of a selfish nature where we say, well, God, don't give us this problem or help it. Instead, we need to be saying, God, whatever comes, help us to remain faithful to you. Help us to deal with that problem. Help us to remain true to you. I want to ask you a question here this morning as we conclude. What kind of God do you serve? Somebody says, well, I don't serve any God. I just do what I want. You serve a God. Whether you realize it or not, you serve either God or Satan. You may think you're only serving yourself or you're serving something else, but you're serving God or Satan. Those are the two most powerful forces in the universe. We've seen what Satan's like. We read in Job about how Satan is just perfectly content to take the lives of innocent individuals, to take all the possessions of an individual, to take the health of someone and leave them painfully suffering. It almost brings you to tears to read the first few chapters of Job and how he must have been suffering. And yet Job, I'll give him the benefit of the doubt. He didn't care. I won't say he enjoyed it. He probably did. The alternative is God. I want to ask each one of you, if you have a Bible here this morning, I want you to turn it to Hosea chapter 11. If you're not real familiar with the Bible, especially in the Old Testament, you'll find Hosea is the first of the minor prophets right after Daniel. Give you some time to find it. We're going to look at Hosea chapter 11. We're going to consider something there. And to set the scene here, Hosea was the individual that God had told, I want you to go and marry a woman that's going to be unfaithful to you. And then when she's unfaithful to you, I want you to go and redeem her again. Hosea preached probably about no more than 40 years before the northern kingdom, Israel, is about to go under. The northern kingdom is about to go. Let's look at Hosea chapter 11. One of the saddest chapters this chapter should just almost make you cry. When Israel was a child, I loved him. And out of Egypt, I called my son. The more they were called, the more they went away. They kept sacrificing to the Baals and burning offerings to idols. Yet it was I who taught Ephraim to walk. I took them up by their arms, but they did not know that I healed them. I led them with cords of kindness, with the bands of love, and I became to them as one who eases the yoke on their jaws. And I bent down to them and fed them. They shall not return to the land of Egypt, but Assyria shall be their king, because they have refused to return to me. The sword shall rage against their cities, consume the bars of their gates, and devour them because of their own counsels. My people are bent on turning away from me, and though they call out to the Most High, He shall not raise them up at all. How can I give you up, O Ephraim? How can I hand you over, O Israel? How can I make you like Adma? How can I treat you like Zeboim? My heart recoils within me. My compassion grows warm and tender. I will not execute my burning anger. I will not again destroy Ephraim. For I am God and not a man, the Holy One in your midst, and I will not come in wrath. They shall go after the Lord. He will roar like a lion when he roars. His children shall come trembling from the west. They shall come trembling like birds from Egypt and like doves from the land of Assyria, and I will return them to their homes, declares the Lord. Ephraim has surrounded me with lies, and the house of Israel with deceit. But Judah still walks with God and is faithful to the Holy One. This is the God that beckons to you today. The one that looked at Israel and with a sad heart said, I have to do what must be done. It's exactly what God was saying in Ezekiel 18, verse 23. I don't enjoy punishing the wicked. I would much rather they repent and live. And that's the God that appeals to you today. You can either serve Satan, who enjoys tormenting people, who enjoys pain and suffering of others, or you can give yourself to God, who only wants the best for you. And that includes your salvation in heaven. God is not the entity that many people paint them out. It's just someone who wants to try and restrict your life to where you have no enjoyment whatsoever. That's not God. Rather, He's a God that loves you. He wants what's best for you. And you can serve Him. You can become a servant of His. And begin to enjoy the benefits of being a child of God. Are you here today and you're not a child of God? Are you yet to have put on your Lord in baptism? The water's ready. We'll be glad to help you to be able to do just that. You can leave here knowing that if you die in a car accident, you're going to heaven. Or perhaps you're an individual that has done all of that and yet you just, maybe you failed too many of those sifting tests and you've yielded to Satan too many times. You recognize you need to get your life back on track with God. If so, we'll be glad to pray with you and help you in any way that we can to help you put yourself back into a right relationship with God. Either way, we beg you to come to the front here as we stand and sing. That song's been selected.